Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. On Sunday, we broadcasted live from the Los Angeles Festival of Books. This program features interviews with some of the top authors who spoke at the festival. So, in this hour, as we celebrate Earth Week, we'll look at America's addiction to garbage, the havoc that it is wreaking, and the possible solutions. Then, the inside story of the anthrax terror case, the scientist who devised the plot, and how this one man and the mystery behind the case helped to fuel the rush to war with Iraq. Finally, the rise of the American right after the Great Depression, the plots to destroy Franklin Roosevelt, and how this history can better prepare us in our current circumstances. America has a problem with trash that might rise to the level of a mental disorder, says our next guest. Could this be what's driving the 389.5 million tons of trash that America tosses out each day? And what is the collective cost to our wastefulness? Billions of dollars are being spent each year to deal with our bad habit. What is the reality of our trashiness, and what can be done about it? Pulitzer Prize winner Edward Humes joins us. He has written 11 acclaimed books, including Force of Nature, Monkey Girl, and his latest, Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. Welcome, Edward Humes.
I'm happy to be here.
Perfect for Earth Day, isn't it?
Exactly so.
So I'd like to start with the numbers. You gave an overview of how much trash each person in the United States is responsible for, kind of what that accumulates into, what the cost of it is. Give us some sense of that.
Well, the first thing to know is that we're really bad at keeping track of how much trash we make. You know, we kind of just roll it out to the curb, it magically disappears, and voila, problem, you know, mischief managed, as Harry Potter used to say. And the reality of it is each of us is making over 7 pounds of trash a day, every man, woman, and child. So if you could hold on to that, collect it, and dump it all on your lawn after a year, you'd know how much trash you make, 1.3 tons per person. That's a very wasteful. It makes us the most wasteful people on the planet.
That's really remarkable. I thought some of the numbers you had in your book were really astounding. 102 tons of trash in each lifetime, which would require 1,100 graves.
Right. It's the biggest thing we make. It's also America's top export now. You know, we are China's trash compactor.
That was actually quite fascinating, too. Let's talk about China, because you featured a particular woman who was a Taiwanese, really, but had escaped the Tiananmen massacre, come over to the United States, and started a little, tiny little business, essentially recycling scraps. Tell us about her.
Well, she became the queen of trash and China's first woman billionaire in its new economy, and she did so starting right here in Los Angeles, collecting paper that was being dumped at landfills and not even recycled, and turned that into a viable business, because China's growing economy and industry and manufacturing base needed paper. And they had serious deforestation, so America's trash was their treasure. And, you know, they buy it for pennies on the dollar, make it into products, and sell it back to us. It's a great economy for them, and for us, it's kind of sad that it's come to that, that we've lost sight of the value of the things that we're throwing away in such vast quantities.
It was paper, and I understand it was also, was it metal recycling also?
Well, that's part of the exports. That's not, the queen of trash was all paper, and she sends it to her own paper company, Nine Dragons in China, which is China's biggest paper manufacturer. But yes, metal scrap is also highly coveted, as is e-waste, which we ship overseas and kind of dust off our hands and say, well, that's good, we got rid of that, but it's ultimately terrible environmental policy and bad economic strategy that we manufacture so much waste. You know, we've come to make waste a synonym for trash, but I think we need to look at the original meaning of it, which waste is the manifestation of wastefulness. You know, trash is something that's worthless we just want to get rid of. Waste, you're actually throwing away valuable material and losing it. And that's really what we do every day.
You know, there were so many aspects of your book, Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, that I found really important to talk about. There was the fact that the EPA and the government numbers in general were off.
And oh, big time.
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted you to talk about. Why is it off, and how far off is it?
Well, this was a discovery I made midway through the book. You mentioned our lifetime legacy of trash is 102 tons. The working title for my book when I first proposed it was 64 tons, because if you listen to the EPA, that's how much trash we make, about 4.5 pounds a day. And the reason they're so wrong is because they don't actually weigh a single piece of trash. They use this very Byzantine materials flow analysis, and they talk to manufacturers and find out how much of everything they make, and then what its life expectancy may be, theoretically, and they extrapolate a figure of how much trash we make from that without actually looking at any trash at all. And that made sense in the 60s when nobody knew who was dumping what where. It was the only way they could get any data. But today, companies and municipalities weigh every ounce of trash that they accept into landfills because it's their economic model to do so. They need to know, and that data is available. And it turns out we send twice as much trash to landfills as the EPA's so-called trash Bible tells us. So it's much worse, and we're recycling much less than those statistics seem to suggest. We're in a bad way.
One of the issues I thought people didn't quite understand was how much the cost of dealing with our trash is, how much cities spend, how much health effect there is. Could you quantify any of that?
It's hard, but if you look at the census data on what cities spend, towns and cities, on things, we spend more on waste management than we do on fire protection, school textbooks, parks and recreation. Really significant and important things are completely outstripped by our waste costs. And New York City spends over $2 billion a year for its trash collection. $300 million of that is just shipping the trash to out-of-state landfills because they have no room for their own trash in New York City. At colossal impact on the environment and the climate as well because of all the emissions from shipping that trash around.
The other thing I thought was important to talk about, you talked about how toxic the leachate is.
Well, leachate is this nasty stuff that comes out of landfills, particularly ones that are older and don't have the plastic linings and barriers that are now required in landfills. But basically, it's the liquefied muck that is, our trash becomes, and that comes out of the bottom. Of course, out of the surface of the landfill, methane is emitted because that's a product of decomposition.
Hydrogen sulfide too, right?
Well, methane is a problem because it's 33 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is, the product of combustion. The EPA actually did a really excellent commission to study on this where the science is very solid. It turns out landfills, which we thought were very safe, have a worse impact on the climate, greater greenhouse gas emissions than if we burned our trash to make electricity, which is the preferred model in Europe. You'd think burning would be worse for the environment, and it turns out in most respects, landfills are worse.
And speaking of Europe, compare the U.S. with Europe in terms of its garbology.
Well, you know, this is one of the areas where America is really lagging behind. Germany is an example. They send essentially zero waste to landfills. Two-thirds of their municipal trash is recycled.
And they are so far ahead of us in so many ways.
And the rest they make energy out of. And they have these modern plants where the dioxin emissions, it's a primary toxin that comes out of burning trash, are actually lower than a backyard barbecue. So they're environmentally sound. Denmark has these plants. One of them's being built right now. It's being hidden behind a community ski park. You know, and communities are proud of these facilities. Contrast that to America. 69% of our trash goes to landfills. It's more than two-thirds. A minuscule amount makes energy, and we recycle about 25%. It's, you know, we're really lagging on that.
The other thing that I thought you brought out here, which was really important, was the economics of the garbology in two ways. One is how we became such a wasteful society, and the other is how maybe, or it seemed you said this in the book, the privatization of the trash industry may have contributed to less sustainable plans. And are those linked?
Well, it's all part of the larger consumer economy where waste itself has come to be viewed perversely, I think, as a bonus, as a plus. The more we waste, it means the more we're throwing away and replacing with new stuff. And that was the post-World War II model for the new economy. I mean, here America was the last of the combatants that was essentially intact. Our homeland hadn't been harmed. And we had this huge industrial base now that geared up for the war and nothing to do with it except make new products. And there was this visionary at the time, that father of corporate branding, his name was J. Gordon Lippincott. And he came up with this vision that, first of all, we need to operate under the principle that we have an unlimited abundance of material and resources in America. We are the nation of abundance. And we need to take that and encourage people to do something no other society has ever done, and that is throw away perfectly good things and replace it with other things. And we need to use the power of marketing to overcome the most basic human instinct, which is the instinct for thrift, in order to do this. And his vision became sort of the marching orders for our new consumer economy. It was no longer the Great Depression motto of waste not, want not. It was waste more, make more. And we haven't left that behind, even
in
though
retail therapy now.
The abundance is not so abundant anymore.
And that would bring us to how you introduced the whole book, which dealt with the hoarders and these couples who had essentially nearly died and died as a result of their trash. But you're saying, in a way, the hoarders are really our saviors.
Well, it's easy to look at them as aberrations, but the amount of trash they accumulate in their homes is perfectly normal. It's just that they do something most of us don't. They recognize it has value. They can't bear to part with it. To them, it's treasures. Now, their clinical response to it isn't so great, but, you know, the rest of us could learn something from the fact that this material does have value. It's worth billions. And that points us to the way back, because wastefulness is the one big social and environmental problem anybody can do something about and actually have an impact, which is the positive side of the story. It's something we can fix, and individuals actually have a profound impact on.
Fix. That's a perfect place that we should end. So if you were going to say these are the top five or top six things that Americans, since we're the biggest wasteful people in the world, it sounds like you're saying, what would those top five or six things be?
Well, refuse things that you don't really need, you know, those tchotchkes, those free car rings, those handouts, junk mail, do what you can to stop that. We get 85 billion pieces of junk mail in a year, 4 million tons of junk mail nobody wants, and we pay for it. We subsidize it with a lower postal rate. Refuse stuff, reuse stuff, you know. And recycling isn't the best solution, but it's better than nothing, so recycle, you know, things that can be recycled. You got to rinse it off before you put it in the recycling bin. Otherwise, it goes to the landfill.
Oh.
If you don't rinse it out, the recyclers won't take it. It's contaminated.
That's interesting. So those are two things?
Those are two things. Refurbished and used merchandise sold by manufacturers, like computers. You get the same warranty, it's lower in price, and you're not making something new. You're repurposing something that's been refurbished. Very good for the environment. Used cars. It's environmentally better to buy a used car than a brand new hybrid. So it's thinking old school. Thrifty school.
Shop at thrift stores.
Waste may not be a sin, but it's really stupid strategy.
Keep things until they're really done.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Well, this is very good. The book, again, is called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. And we've been sitting here with Edward Humes, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for the really informative and important book.
Thanks.
When we come back, the rise of the American right after the Great Depression, the plots to destroy President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and how this history can better prepare us in our present circumstances. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. On Sunday, we broadcasted live from the Los Angeles Festival of Books. This program features interviews with some of the top authors who spoke at the festival. The conditions in America's dark, cruel years were desperate for Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal, according to our next guest. Quote, unemployment had tripled and was surpassing 16 million. Farm foreclosures exceeded 500,000. More than 5,000 banks had failed and 86,000 businesses had closed. Millions of unemployed wandered the country. Suicide rates tripled. Men stood all night in unemployment lines just to be among the first applicants in the morning, end quote. But Roosevelt's efforts to restore the U.S. economy were met by another set of dark forces that sought to destroy him and all of his policies. What were those forces, and how might they still resonate today? Sally Denton joins us. She is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and the author of numerous books, including The Pink Lady, American Massacre, and her latest, The Plots Against the President, FDR, A Nation in Crisis, and the Rise of the American Right. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. You know, I thought the place to start after reading your book was really with the Hoover years.
Uh-huh.
Because this really described this immense splitting of the nation. Mm-hmm. The extreme rich, almost what we have today, except for the extreme poor, was much worse. So I thought we'd start you there to tell us, what was the nation facing?
Well, it was facing very much similar to what we were facing when Obama took office. And you're right, the extremes of the rich and the poor were basically the same, except that there were no safety nets. There was no Social Security, no unemployment, no food stamps, no Medicare. So it was much more dire. The poor were in even far worse conditions than today. But it was really kind of, it was very similar in that there was, the nation was on the brink of economic collapse, and nobody quite knew who could right this sinking ship. And when Roosevelt, my book is about a narrow window from November 1932, when Roosevelt defeated Herbert Hoover, to the end of 1933, his first year in office. And during that time, there was an assassination attempt on Roosevelt and a coup attempt. And so I really use those two events to kind of be the bookend to this narrative about, not about Roosevelt himself as much about as about his policies and the efforts to thwart him.
And you did this great job of contrasting it with those Hoover years, particularly, this is what I thought was kind of a great contrast, both with the policies that certain people are promoting today with Hoover, and then with some of the policies that FDR brought in contrast with a little bit with President Obama, and the similar kind of uprisings on both sides of the aisle that were occurring. One of the things with Hoover, you noted that he was championing this monopolistic economy that really did support the merging of the banks and the railroads in a concentration of wealth. And he believed that this would be a good thing, ultimately.
Yes. I mean, I think that there was this concept. This was kind of the beginning of the multinational corporations, that we didn't really have those yet. But it was basically the merging of these giant monopolistic economic fortunes. And the New Deal, which Roosevelt instituted, was really to kind of regulate all of this, that it was clear that this was not going to work toward a middle class. And I think it was always, he always found it ironic that he was called a traitor to his class, because he felt that he really had saved capitalism, and that he had not been a traitor, but he had really saved capitalism and democracy for America.
Right, and some people did acknowledge that at the time.
At the time,
the far left.
Well, if there was
and
a far left.
And they criticized him for that.
Yeah. I mean, he was attacked by both the far left and the far right, by Huey Long on the left and Father Coughlin on the right. But everybody was, you know, he was making it up as he was going along that first 100 days. And they weren't really that radical. I mean, he was putting people back to work, and he was trying to build a new infrastructure in America. And it was actually a pretty conservative approach. But there was so much, and initially when he you know, save the banks and the financial institutions, they all welcomed it. But then when they realized it was not free, that he also was going to, the government was going to regulate them, then there was this severe backlash against him.
Now, didn't he borrow some of the policies in rescuing the banks from Hoover?
Oh, yes. In fact, exactly from Hoover. And from, I mean, he used the Hoover advisors and Secretary of Treasury to basically do exactly what Hoover had been trying to do. But Hoover had lost the faith of the American public. And he had been in such denial about the actual situation in America that he really had no support.
That sounds also somewhat similar to what we dealt with, right? So we had George Bush in the White House and the efforts that he wanted to do towards the large corporations, and then President Obama kept some of those people.
I mean, I don't know whether or not, I mean, this is an argument. I mean, I'm not an Obama scholar or an economist or anything, but I mean, I think there's this sense that, you know, you bring in the people, you know, it was like Roosevelt putting Joseph Kennedy in charge of the SEC. I mean, he always said you need to, you know, bring the foxes into the hen house to keep the other foxes, because they understand what's going on. So there is that sense, whether or not it's legitimate, but certainly, you know, Obama inherited a disaster equal to what Roosevelt inherited.
Before we talk about the assassination attempts and such, there were a few other things that I had never read before that I thought were really quite interesting in your book. And one was during the Year of Fear, there was this intellectual exploration that maybe was unprecedented in America. I don't know, where some academics were pushing for their students to go totalitarian.
Well, yeah, there was everything was at play that year in 1932. And there was a real sense that the whole system had failed, that democracy had failed, that capitalism had failed. And yes, the intellectual elite was toying with the possibility of instituting a fascist government, that maybe American democracy had run its course. The country was in economic collapse and there seemed no way out. And so there was, on all sides, I mean, there was also, you know, from the left, there was a kind of a flirting with socialism too, and with what was going on in Russia and the Bolshevik Revolution, and you know, it just was like a tempestuous moment of revolutionary ferment, intellectual and economic and cultural and everything.
And FDR himself even sent a reporter over to interview Mussolini and Hitler to try to learn from them.
Well, I think he sent that his emissary there was more to see what kind of adversaries they might turn out to be. But some of the people involved in the business plot, you know, they sent somebody there to look at what how fascist organizations use veterans organizations to install a fascist totalitarian dictator. And yes, you're right. I mean, there were people at, you know, universities, university professors and administrators who were suggesting that America go toward a totalitarian government. And there were powerful leaders, members of the media who were also espousing this.
Yeah, do you actually showed how much of the media did not really welcome FDR. They didn't think he was particularly qualified to govern. They were very critical of him before he was elected.
Yeah, well, nobody quite knew what he was going to do, actually. I mean, he was kind of a dilettante and a party boy and an aristocrat. So there was this concern that he was just going to be more of the same. But it wasn't until he got into office and then started what he did do in the first 100 days, especially, that there was this concept that, wow, we have really gotten, you know, a handle on, I mean, we've got somebody in there who really has a new approach.
And then you mentioned just a minute ago, and I thought it was really important, the criticism coming from, say, Governor Huey Long, and also Father Charles Coughlin, and they, Coughlin had a huge audience.
They both did. Father Coughlin was called the father of hate radio, and he was one of the first to be able to use and manipulate radio to a huge extent. And so he was coming at, he became seriously anti-communist, anti-Semitic, and there was this cottage industry to prove that Roosevelt was a Jew. And so there were the anti-Semites, anti-communists on the left, upset because Roosevelt had acknowledged the Soviet Union. And then there was, the Huey Long or on the right, and then there was Huey Long on the left that thought that his policies had not gone far enough for creating a middle class and sharing the wealth and decentralization of the nation's wealth.
I just want to remind people that we're speaking with Sally Denton, and her book is called The Plots Against the President, FDR, A Nation in Crisis and the Rise of the American Right. So take us to Miami. Now, Miami was, it seemed like this ultra-conservative, seemed like very racist by the way you described it, kind of city at the time.
This is, 1933, spring of 1933, and Miami was really kind of the nexus point for the destruction of the economic destruction in America. And it was very racist, xenophobic. The Ku Klux Klan was very active there. But it's just as kind of a sideshow. Roosevelt, while he was waiting to take office in March, was cruising the Caribbean on the world's most luxurious liner, the Normahal, and came into Miami preparing to take a train up to Washington for the inauguration. And he came in, and there was an Italian anarchist there that was plotting his assassination. And so when he spoke at Bayfront Park, his whole entourage, this guy opened fire on the entourage, which included numerous people, but five were shot, and the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak, died from the wounds. But and even then, Roosevelt tried to make it seem as if it was, Roosevelt participated in those that were kind of dismissing it. There was a rumor that maybe Cermak had been the intended target because he was from Chicago and had supposedly been, threatening Al Capone. And so that kind of served everybody's purposes to say Cermak was the target instead of Roosevelt. And Roosevelt went along with that because he believed that the nation was in such a precarious state that the last thing the country needed was, that there was an assassination attempt on the president-elect.
But in fact, you think that it was.
Oh, I think there's no question. And the assassin, Zangara, always said that he wanted to kill all capitalists. He was trying to kill Roosevelt. He would have killed Hoover, but he didn't want to go to Washington to do it. But this was a time before he took office, as I said, when nobody quite knew, what Roosevelt was going to do. And so Giuseppe Zangara, the assassin, saw him as, exactly the same as Herbert Hoover.
Hmm. So this was the incident that seemed to have prompted the famous speech.
Right. The fear itself, nothing to fear.
Nothing to fear, but fear.
Well,
itself.
At that point, once he survived this, he was seen as larger than life. He had survived polio, and now, this man that seemed kind of like a feckless playboy suddenly had, rock star quality for being courageous, because not only did he was he not shot, but he saved Cermak initially. He brought him
Didn't
into the car. Brought him into the car and spoke to him and kept him from going into shock. And so when he then arrived in New York, he got, this hero's welcome. And then from that point on, it was in the newsreels how courageous this man was. And I think that really bolstered his ability to get the people behind him. And if you look at his inaugural speech, it was less about, what was going to happen, and really more about just, bolstering up Americans to kind of get together, that there was going to be action, even if he didn't know what the action was going to be. Going to be action.
And he was drawing from all these different academics.
Yeah, which was great. I think one of the great things about him was his ability to, he wasn't threatened by others who were as smarter or more competent. He really wanted the input from all the great minds in America.
And then there were the conspiracy theorists. There was the other coup attempts. Give us a thumbnail sketch of all that.
Well, the coup attempt in a nutshell was an attempt by some Wall Street plotters who were upset mostly about his monetary policies, especially, taking America off the gold standard. There was this sense that that maybe we should have a fascist dictatorship and that he could be removed. In fact, there was a sense that he could be removed voluntarily. But they came to a general, a retired general named Smedley Butler, and asked him to lead this half-million-man veterans' army that had been, you know, World War One veterans who were very disaffected anyway because they hadn't gotten their bonuses from World War One and had marched on Washington, and Herbert Hoover had routed them out, General MacArthur had routed them out, so that you had this potential half-million member army. And the plotters sent one of their people to Europe to explore how this could be put into effect.
Now, you ended the book really kind of reflecting on America and this kind of paranoia that has been its political way of operating. If we were going to go, okay, here we are, decades later, what can we draw from that era to today?
Well, I think, I mean, I didn't, in the book, I didn't draw any of the parallels because I just thought that I would leave it to the reader to do that. But I end it with a Richard Hofstadter quote on the paranoid style of American politics. And I think, you know, the parallels to today are that when economic times are hard, it's very easy to kind of foment this dissatisfaction and unrest among those that have less. I mean, especially when you've got the haves and the have-nots and this extreme difference in...
But it seemed like it was also coming from the haves that wanted to cling to their power.
Which you see today as well. I mean, that's
what
the multinational corporations and the, you know, I mean...
They just want more.
They just want more. Exactly. I mean, we've lost this sense of, I mean, what Roosevelt... The same issue today is the same as Roosevelt, which is what is the role that government should play in American life? And that's what's at the root of the Tea Party, so it's at the root of everything. And Roosevelt and his advisors believe that, you know, to have a civilized society, that you don't want people dying in the streets of hunger and poverty.
Well, that's a perfect place to end. Sally Denton, thank you so much. The Plots Against the President, FDR, A Nation in Crisis, and the Rise of the American Right. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Grimy, checked in with a pseudonym, so I guess you could say I'm Mark Twaining. Read so hard, I'm not lazy. Go on good, read so much rated. Fountainhead, I'm a just read. Gave it 4 stars and then changed it. Read so hard, I'm literary.
Goosebumps series, too scary.
Animal Farm, Jane Eyre. Barnes and Nobles, Foursquare. No TV, I read instead. Got lots of bills, but not bread. Burroughs, Golding, Shakespeare, all dead. Read so hard, got paper cuts. On trends while you're playing connect the dots. All these blisters from turning pages. Read so hard, I'm seeing spots. Sudoku just can't compare. Nor Angry Birds, cause look at here. My little birds is getting stares. This print's rare. Read so hard, I memorized the Iliad. I know lines. Watch you spit. Classic lit. Epic poems that don't rhyme. War and Peace, piece of cake. Read Tolstoy in 3 days. Straight through, no delays. Didn't miss a word, not one phrase. Read so hard, library's trying to find me. That shit crack. That shit crack. That shit crack.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. On Sunday, we broadcasted live from the Los Angeles Festival of Books. This program features interviews with some of the top authors who spoke at the festival. While America was still terrorized by the events of 9/11, an Army scientist embarked upon another deadly act. He mailed cultivated anthrax spores to U.S. senators and media outlets. Bruce Ivins was not on the FBI's radar screen as the culprit behind the acts. But after one of the most complex investigations, the agency finally settled on Ivins as the most likely culprit. By then, the U.S. had already argued that Iraq was involved in the spread of the anthrax and gone to war with that country. Why would a scientist like Bruce Ivins engage in such an effort to destroy? Why was this case so difficult to solve? And how did the anthrax attacks affect American life? With us is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author David Willman. His book, Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks and America's Rush to War, digs into the man, his life, and the case of the anthrax letter attacks. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. I think the place that I'd want to start with this is this man himself. He was a very bizarre character, seemed to be perfectly harmless on the face of everything, but he had this kind of dark side. How did you discover Bruce Ivins and each of the sides that he actually, these facets of him, and how did people find him generally?
Well, people found him in different ways and typically the way he wanted them to find him. But the breakthrough for me was going to Bruce Ivins' hometown of Lebanon, Ohio, which is a small little town about 40 miles northeast of Cincinnati. And on its surface, it's Norman Rockwell, Middle America. But I was able, fortunate enough to be able to speak to dozens of townspeople there. I should say dozens that remembered him, people who went to elementary and high school with him, actually high school teachers, his former drama coach, if you will, his drama teacher. And
what a drama he created.
Absolutely. And what I found was that Bruce Ivins from very early age was socially maladjusted. He had very few friends. He was a loner. He was had very odd appearance, which he was incredibly self-aware of. And so he was driven by getting two things in his life as a young person, and this is a through line into his 60s. Those two things are attention and approval. Now, a lot of us like those things. I do, too. The difference with Bruce Ivins is that he went about getting them in increasingly just bizarre ways.
And revenge.
Revenge, when he felt slighted, it was a vendetta, and often it was a lifetime vendetta. And so what I found was that the Bruce Ivins on the surface was the church-going family man, the can-do colleague, I'm here to help you. Beneath the surface, what people didn't know was that he was leading a double life, a secret life. He was, in fact, a mirage, hence the title, The Mirage Man.
Did you get a sense that anybody knew this dark side, his wife, his two adopted kids, anybody?
I think there were inklings of these things. I tell you, two people who had a very clear idea of his dark side were the psychiatrist to whom he confessed a specific murder plot in 1979. Now, this is within a year of when the United States Army hired him to be a civilian scientist handling the most lethal form of anthrax known to exist. But he confessed this plot to his then psychiatrist, Dr. Naomi Heller, which I bring out in the book for the first time. And it was regarding a woman who he felt rejected by way back in the days when he was a postdoctoral researcher at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She had been a member of Kappa Kappa Gamma. She was an attractive woman, an extremely intelligent woman, a doctoral student. She tried to put space between them. He couldn't handle it. And then fast forwarding
to... Which one was this? There were two women I remember specifically in the book.
This is Nancy Hagwood.
Right.
Okay.
Boy, he did some awful things to her.
He tormented her for decades.
Right. We'll go back to her.
We'll circle back to her. The second woman was then recently departed lab technician at Fort Detrick, which is the United States Army's Biowarfare Research Center. Bruce Ivins was completely obsessed with this woman whose name is Mara Lynn Scott. And in July of 2000, Bruce Ivins confided to another therapist, chapter and verse detail, a plot that he had just, he said, abandoned to poison and kill Mara Lynn Scott. Now, he had reasons for why he abandoned both plots, but those two individuals, for sure, were onto him, but they were bound by the privilege. The second therapist did call the police, tried to get them involved, but because the plot had been ostensibly abandoned, according to the law, there wasn't really anything they could do.
So were they talking to you now mainly because he had already committed suicide? Or did they talk to you before he had committed suicide?
Oh, no, I tracked those people down during the research for this book after he was dead of suicide on July 29th, 2008. And both of them were very reluctant to talk to me, as you can imagine. They're very concerned about the privilege.
Exactly.
And there were also... issues with being tied up in the criminal investigation. Even though Ivins was dead, a lot of people felt that they couldn't discuss what they knew.
So let me remind listeners that we're talking with David Willman, and the book he wrote is called The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. Right now we're talking about Bruce Ivins, the man who ultimately was found to be the person behind the anthrax attacks, who was an Army scientist, and talking about what the motives could have been for him doing this, and kind of this bizarre character that nobody quite understood. One key I thought that was most telling was this obsession with the sorority, Kappa Kappa Gamma, that started with this unrequited love. But talk about how obsessed he was and what were all the things he did to that sorority and members of the sorority.
Right. Kappa Kappa Gamma does factor into, I think, what you would have to say is part of the motive. But when Bruce Ivins was an undergrad at the University of Cincinnati, he asked a young woman out for a date, which was something that was done at the, in the day, and she said no.
I think we still do that, don't we, ask people out for dates? I mean, you know.
Yeah, I meant I call it a date, but yeah, in any event. So the woman moved on, said no. He never got over it. And he actually started casing the Kappa House in Cincinnati, keeping close tabs on comings and goings, and targeted that sorority and certain members of it who he had later brushes with for his entire life. I mean, he committed two in the middle of the night burglaries where he stole artifacts from Kappa Kappa Gamma. One of them was the Book of Ritual, another one was the cipher to decode the Book of Ritual. He then took out classified advertisements in Mother Jones magazine and in Rolling Stone and offered the Kappa secrets to anyone who would write into him. He was posting this classified ad as a woman, as a disgruntled Kappa. And the woman's name, by the way, was a knockoff of the last name of Nancy Hagwood's husband. In any event, he would then mail these secrets to these women. Nancy Hagwood, he kept up after. I'll just give one quick anecdote.
Yeah,
in,
definitely.
In 1983, a letter appeared in the Frederick, Maryland News Post in the name of Nancy Hagwood. And it archly defended hazing as a character-building thing. And the letter says, you know, I'm Nancy Hagwood. I'm a member of Kappa Kappa Gamma. Hazing is good. Forget what the media says. Forget what other liberals say. This is a great thing. Okay, so then Nancy...
But only published. She didn't write it.
Nancy Hagwood, a colleague at work, says, hey, I saw your letter to the editor. And she says, what? What are you talking about? So then she called the paper, said, I didn't write that letter. So, you know, you could sort of maybe chalk that up in a vacuum to say, that's a one-off. It's a weird thing. For a guy who's almost 40 years old, it's pretty twisted. He took it another step. And this was one of the most, I thought, revealing things about Ivan's character that I found in my research that is... You know, it's all related to his character, so when you're trying to understand him. Bruce Ivins wasn't satisfied with having that letter published. And he was the master, by the way, of the anonymously written, falsely named letter. But he takes that letter, cuts it out, and mails it to a woman on Long Island, in Sayville, New York, a woman named Eileen Stevens, who has recently lost her firstborn child, a 20-year-old son, in a horrific hazing incident, died in the trunk frozen of a car in upstate New York. And Bruce Ivins writes to her and says, can you believe this Nancy Hagwood? What is with her? The reason why Bruce Ivins was doing that was that Eileen had recently appeared on The Donahue Show, had appeared in the Ann Landers column. She was trying to extract some good from her tragedy, and she had a national foundation going. And she mentioned on The Donahue Show that she was getting tons of mail already from the Landers column, anecdotes about hazing incidents. Bruce Ivins was specifically soliciting her for any dirt that she had on Kappa Kappa Gamma. He was willing to exploit a mother's grief, the worst form of grief, as anyone who's had a child, I think, can appreciate, for his little game.
And his hatred for Nancy was, it seemed like, merely yet another rejection.
Yes. He told Dr. Heller in 1979 that he coveted Nancy Hagwood for her qualities that he felt that he didn't have in his own wife.
He stole her thesis or something, didn't he?
Well, yes. After he had left UNC Chapel Hill, he drove down to Chapel Hill. He broke into a room on campus, stole her doctoral thesis. This is in 1978, 79.
I shudder, given that I'm finishing mine right now.
Right. Well, and in that day, forget the terminology dates, there were no flash drives. So all of Nancy Hagwood's future scientific career in her eyes were in this lab notebook. And so it was gone. Nancy Hagwood then received an anonymous note saying, if you want your notebook back, go to this post box at this corner on this day, and you'll find it in there. So she had the cops already engaged. They went there and they found it. Bruce Ivins ultimately confessed all of these things, by the way, in interviews with the FBI in 2008.
Just fascinating. So let's now take it to the investigation and to the larger political occurrences as a result of Bruce Ivins and the anthrax poisoning, or the mailing. He did kill some people as a result of this. But so there's several things. One is, why did he target the people he targeted with the anthrax?
Okay. Bruce Ivins was a student, a close student, of how the media works in this country and how elected officials work and how policy works. And as anybody who follows a scintilla of news knows, what gets through policy-wise often bears little resemblance to merit. But what this country moves on is crisis and fear. Fear, crisis, crisis, fear. Bruce Ivins had a ringside seat to that during the first Persian Gulf War. He was enlisted as a trusted small circle of scientists at Fort Detrick to try and come up with some means to protect our troops going into the first Gulf War, because there was intelligence that Saddam might hit him with anthrax or botulinum. Okay? So Ivins saw how all the old hurdles to getting things done were suddenly out the window. This is a guy who wrote scores of letters, by the way, to media outlets, to members of Congress. He was definitely tuned in that way. So Bruce Ivins, to stand back a second, the most important aspect of his scientific career was the development of a genetically engineered next generation called anthrax vaccine. As you'll recall, your listeners will recall, tremendous controversy over the original anthrax vaccine in the Gulf War, with all sorts of concern about side effects. So Bruce Ivins was working, in fact, this product was called within the Army Bruce's baby. It was the next generation anthrax vaccine, and boy, you know, this was going to be the, well, what happened was that it never got the push that he felt it deserved. It was failing in a lot of animal testing. I mean, things are good in theory.
And so the senators he targeted, were they tied to him, his project not becoming pushed forward?
No, I'm getting to the essence of the motive, which was he was creating a panic. He knows that nothing's going to happen. He had been told in meetings at the Pentagon that he attended that his vaccine was done. It's going nowhere. It's beyond the back burner, which I bring out in the words of the then supervising major general in the Mirage Man. So Bruce Ivins, I think the reasonable conclusion is he knows the only thing that's going to get his vaccine back in the game is crisis. So we have the anthrax letter attacks, which who are the anthrax letters sent to? The most notorious tabloid in the nation or the world, the National Enquirer, the Pentagon Office of the National Enquirer, two United States senators, Daschle and
Both
Leahy.
Democrats.
And there's maybe another twofer with them that I can get back to. He sent it to the New York Post, which is the top mainstream tabloid. And then for good measure, he sent it to Tom Brokaw. So if you're trying to create maximum shock and awe, you couldn't have had a better list. So there were a ton, we can get into the policy ramifications of the anthrax letter attacks. One of them was Project BioShield. The first contract that was awarded under the multi-billion dollar Project BioShield was for $877.5 million for the development of Bruce's baby, the next generation anthrax vaccine. Never would have happened without the anthrax letter attacks. And a product upon which Bruce Ivins held two patents, by the way.
Now, I don't want to run out of time before we get into some of the analysis you did of the FBI and the media at the time. These are very important. The FBI targeted the wrong person initially. How do we explain this?
Well, the FBI, you know, was already stretched to the limit investigating 9/11. And so now we have the dreaded second wave attack. So the FBI is already stretched. They've never investigated an anthrax crime before. I mean, a real anthrax crime. There's a lot of hoax letters, but anthrax murders, there's five murders, and you got 17 other people that are hospitalized or otherwise injured. So they're running uphill, and they don't have a bicycle or a car. So you've got several people who are making phone calls in saying, you got to look at this guy, Stephen Hatfield. He's a swashbuckler. So they had to look at him hard. Meanwhile, Bruce Ivins is sitting at Fort Detrick, and he becomes sort of an ongoing consultant to the FBI because they don't know anything about this strain of anthrax. They're trying to get on top of things. And they overlook some very troubling signs that were right there in plain sight on Bruce Ivins.
And then you also noted how the media were pretty irresponsible. This is partly during the time when Colin Powell was standing before the United Nations and the whole world, believing and expressing the belief that Iraq was involved in this anthrax,
right?
And the media went with it.
They actually preceded Colin Powell by a good long way. The performance, when you look at it with the benefit of hindsight, is shockingly awful. Brian Ross, the most prestigious investigative journalist in broadcast news, went on the air with an exclusive on World News Tonight the last week of October 2001 and said he had three firsthand sources who have seen the analysis of the attack material that was sent to Senator Daschle, and that it has an additive that links up to Saddam Hussein's bioweapons program. Well, I mean, this is casus belli. This is a laydown cause of action for war, and there are people in the White House I document who never let loose of that. Paul Wolfowitz never let loose of that. You have all these ideologues, not only within the Bush administration, but a fair number of them in what we could generally call the media, that were just thrilled to go with this narrative. And they did. despite the fact that the best scientific analysis that would ever be done was completed by April, May, June of 2002 at the Sandia National Laboratory, establishing that there was no additive in this anthrax. So there was no chemical signatures to Saddam. But as former Homeland Security Advisor Tom Ridge has told me, and he's in the book, people throughout the White House and at the Pentagon, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and these other people, they reached facts without conclusions. They would not back off of it. And so we go.
How do we explain the dereliction of duty of, well, I, being in the journalism world myself, of the journalists? Did you interview any of them about this?
Yeah, I engaged with every journalist whose work I wrote about.
And how do they justify
it? Well, Brian Ross's final response, it was by email, was essentially to throw his unnamed sources under the bus. Now, that was really interesting because as of the time the book was published, the ABC News website was still claiming credit for his exclusives on the anthrax case, which are totally discredited. But I'll give Brian credit. I mean, he does say his sources were wrong, but what I also established in this book is that he never had a firsthand source for this work, never. The other journalist whose work I think is so startlingly wrong is Nick Kristof, who's a star columnist for the New York Times, who was hectoring the FBI for not charging Stephen Hatfield for the anthrax murders. And I engaged with Kristof, and ultimately, I guess his bottom line was sort of just to throw his hands up, palms up in the air, and point me to Hatfield's lawyers. I mean, he claimed in his columns that Hatfield had an up-to-date anthrax vaccination at the time of the anthrax letter attacks. That is not established by the record. In fact, his supervisor, in sworn testimony that I reviewed, said he did not have an up-to-date anthrax vaccine. He said that Hatfield likely was passing out Cipro, which is the anthrax antidote, to friends at a secluded cabin that may have been a CIA safe house. And I've reviewed the sworn testimony of everyone who can be identified who was at a social gathering there. They said there was never any Cipro handed out, nothing of the kind. And Kristof would never say, has never withdrawn on that, has never said he was wrong on the facts. He did say in a column in August 2008, a month after Ivan's suicide, that he owed Dr. Hatfield an apology. That's as far as he went. Mm.
And how did the FBI finally figure out what had actually occurred?
Well, I think that's a great question. And again, the Mirage Man brings that out for the first time, because there was a war within the FBI investigation, and some very heroic agents, led by one in particular, spoke truth to power at risk to their own careers.
And isn't that always the case, it seems?
Well, it was the case here. And so they ultimately turned around this investigation, but the FBI director has never really stood up and said, you know what, we got it wrong on Stephen Hatfield. So I think the American public is reluctant to trust the FBI on its final conclusion, because the director has never really atoned and explained why they were so wrong for so long on Stephen Hatfield.
All right, so just a reminder that we've been speaking with David Willman, sorry about that, get a little tongue twisted here. He's the author of The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivan's The Anthrax Attacks and America's Rush to War. Thank you so very much.
Just a reminder, as we come up to May 1st, that while the day originally marked a Celtic celebration, it came to recognize another important historic event, the Haymarket Massacre in Chicago. On May 1, after police fired on and killed workers demonstrating for an 8-hour workday, May Day came to mark International Workers' Day. It is now recognized by some 80 countries worldwide. In 2006, for the first time, many rights activists in the United States expanded the day's meaning by demonstrating against increasingly draconian laws aimed at immigrants. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, Ishmael Karim, and Amanda Vigil, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at armudian.